It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at how terrorism has evolved over the last decade or so and why attacks like the one in France are becoming the ones to watch out for.
First, a project to build a massive ice sculpture is underway in Superior, and when completed, could set a world record.
The man behind the project, Roger Hansen, is hard at work on the 70-foot-tall sculpture with the help of a robot he developed that sprays water. Roger is a Minnesota-based engineer, software developer, and ice artist. He joins us now to talk more about the project. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Yes, very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us about your sculpture.
Well, it's right now it's about 52 feet high, and at the very top, maybe about 20, 25 feet wide. And it's coming along pretty well. We've had very, very good temperatures here and good conditions for making ice so far this year. But at the onset this year, we had some really, really big problems. This sculpture is on a man-made island, and the sand that's been dredged up from the St. Louis is pretty soft. So at the onset, this thing started to tilt, and it got was very precarious for a while there, but I arrested that, and it's looking pretty good right now.
What's the finished sculpture going to look like?
It will look kind of like a, it will have a peak in the center, and about, the edges will go back about, it'll be about 90 feet wide, and hopefully we'd be about 70 feet in the center, and on the very edges, maybe 50 feet. And like I say, it being about 90 feet wide, it looked like a big wall.
Would this be the biggest ice sculpture in the world?
Yes, it will. The biggest freestanding ice sculpture, therefore having no mechanical support structures to support it.
Now, you invented a sprayer, Roger. How does it work? How do you spray the ice on?
We've got, well, first of all, there's two towers that are about 82 feet high that are set about 160 feet apart. From those towers, there's a cable that goes across, and I can lower and raise that cable at will. And I lower it down to about, maybe 30 feet for the first tier. And from that, I form ice on it, and that droops down. And then after it's formidable, I start the second tier. Now, the tiers are made from another tower that has a robotic ice sprayer on it. Now, this robotic ice sprayer has also got a weather station on top of it to tell me the direction and the speed of the wind. And all this data goes into the computer. We take the temperature along with the wind direction and wind speed. And then in the program, we've got set positioning points. I can make as many of these positioning points on the system as I want. And what we do, what the robot system does, it tries to target these points using the wind and the direction, the wind speed, and adjusting the angle in order to hit that target. That's the magic of this system, is to be able to hit that target repeatedly. You cannot do it just by trying to point it and spray. And by doing this, we can hit a small focal point and put the water exactly where it's needed.
That's amazing. Roger, why did you get into making ice sculptures?
Why don't people climb mountains?
When did you?
We've got a geothermal heating system at our house. We've got this water that was being expelled out into the river, and I just thought it would be neat to probably start playing with that. Well, with my experiences in the different avenues of technologies, such as mechanical engineering and electronics engineering and software development, it kind of all fit. You know, you put that together and, gosh, I can do something with this. It may seem, it may be frivolous, and it may make a lot of nonsense, but I thought, you know, it might be kind of fun. But as it turns out, I'm finding that the public and the people are really interested in what I do, and that's what makes it so fun.
When are you going to be done with this, Roger?
Well, I don't know. It's all up to the weather. I like to tell people I'm just a contractor. I put the infrastructure there. Mother Nature is the real artist, and it's up to her as to what she wants to do. Sometimes she's got some very strange ideas. And if I trying to circumvent those ideas proves very futile at times, but I'm kind of planning on by the end of January, I should have something pretty formal. This is called the Lake Superior Ice Project, and the reason we call it the Lake Superior Ice Project is because of its nature of being an ongoing project. This thing changes all the time, so as you see it, right now today, this is the finished product today. Tomorrow, I'll have a different finished product.
And people can stop by and check out the work in progress?
Yes. This is free to the public, and people can stop by at any time, and day or night. I'm lighting this system at night, so it's we're trying to make it as appear as good as we can, so that people can really enjoy it.
Roger, thank you so much for taking time with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on. It's been my pleasure.
That's Roger Hansen. He's a Minnesota-based engineer and ice artist working on this Lake Superior ice project in Superior. You can check out some pictures of the work in progress. Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page for a link. Last week's terrorist attacks against French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo are a reflection of a newer style of terrorism, according to some experts.
Targeted, smaller-scale attacks have become more common, and they may be harder to prevent. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder on Face the Nation on CBS on Sunday, talking about long-term changes in terror threats.
The decimation of core al-Qaeda has probably reduced, if not eliminated, the ability of al-Qaeda to do the kind of thing that they did on September the 11th. On the other hand, al-Qaeda affiliates like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has moved what they do to smaller kinds of attacks. They have inspired people negatively around the world to engage in these really small small attacks that involve only one or two people, a small number of arms, that can have a devastating impact, as we have seen in France. But we have been in this phase of the fight against terrorism for some time.
William Banks joins us now to talk about changing trends in terrorism and how security agencies can adapt. He's the director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University. William, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
Well, we just heard Attorney General Eric Holder. Do you think he's right, first of all, that the age of the large-scale terrorist attack, the September 11th type of dramatic attack, is more or less, hopefully, over?
Well, I tend to agree with the Attorney General, although it's a little dangerous to jump to that conclusion. I think there's still a possibility for larger scale attacks, but the smaller ones are easier. They're harder to detect. They're easier, that is, operationally for the bad guys to carry out. They're harder for us to detect. And, you know, the terrorists succeeded in a certain way last week in France in getting themselves heard. So I think we'll certainly see more of that, even if we might also expect a larger scale attack at some time.
So how can Homeland Security agencies here in the United States, other countries around the world, adapt to keep on top of this different kind of attack?
Yeah, it's a greater challenge in some ways. One of the things, or one of the dynamics at work now, of course, is the Syria conflict. It's been a real magnet for what we now call foreign terrorist fighters, FTF. And that conflict itself has drawn thousands of travelers from mostly from Western Europe, but at least a couple of hundred from the United States who've been drawn to the conflict, either for ideological reasons or for financial gain. They actually pay bonuses there for fighters to come fight for one group or another. Some just for for the adventure of it or to engage in criminal activity. But so the volume of traffic of those who've been radicalized and then trained in one way or another, and then returning back to their home country, a Western democracy in Europe or the United States, Canada, it just elevates the scale of the challenges for law enforcement and intelligence. And as the French have said about last week's events, they had these brothers on their radar for some time, but they simply didn't have the resources devoted to intelligence to watch them 24/7. They had other things to do. Inevitably, that's going to be the case anywhere where intelligence and law enforcement are working. You have limited resources.
Now, looking at groups around the world, ISIS, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, groups like that, are they becoming more sophisticated, more successful in using the Internet as a tool of either recruiting people to come and join them or to inspire people to action elsewhere in the world?
They are. You know, I think that's demonstrable in a number of recent episodes. We've seen the sophistication of their web presence and their ability, say, to hack into accounts and take over, as they did here yesterday in the United States with the social media of the Central Command of the Department of Defense. That was a pretty stunning accomplishment in and of itself. So, leading to the question of how do we respond to that, I think building counter narratives is a very important part of the picture here. It's not just a law enforcement and intelligence problem; it's an education and community-based problems, so that those who might be inclined to be radicalized should be countered at the narrative stage back home before they travel, or in the less positive case, from when they've returned before they would carry out an unlawful act. I think there's a fair amount of attention being paid here and in Europe now to what we call countering violent extremism, CVE programs, that try to provide alternatives to violence and in part to show the horror and negative consequences of the bad acts that the terrorists are perpetrating or that the Syrian groups are engaging in and fighting with each other.
Well, that sounds like a huge task, crafting a message for people in the West, for people who are going to the Middle East maybe to seek training, something that makes sense and that might actually change minds within the context of their culture, of their upbringing. I mean, are we good enough at counter propaganda to come up with something like that?
Well, you know, we're not. But the allies that we should have here are the community members who are closer to these people and who have influence through family and social networks, not necessarily digital or electronic, but actually people-to-people. So community groups, public organizations, NGOs of the kind that can appeal to individuals who may need some job training, they may need counseling, they may need just simply something to do, or a way to talk through their frustrations at what messages they're getting either from electronic means or otherwise.
Are we seeing people we're talking about Muslim communities in the West, in the United States, and in Europe, stepping up and saying, hey, government operations, we want to cooperate with you on this kind of counter-violence messaging?
We are, here in the United States and abroad. I think it's there's some encouraging developments in that regard, some that are the product of government initiatives and some that have simply come up, say, through mosques and imams and religious communities here and abroad.
It seems like there might be a conflict, though, in how much you want to cooperate. Are we, in a sense, snitching on our own people in a heavy-handed surveillance effort? Where do you draw the line between that and more positive programming?
Yes, that, you know, most of us have read about the instances of snooping inside religious communities in New York City and elsewhere. And we have to be very careful not to engage in that. It's a tension that we can't ever remove, that is, between protecting our security and assuring our religious and other personal liberties. But the line has to be very studiously observed, and I think Attorney General Holder would agree with that, that it needs a lot of attention to keep up with on a regular basis.
Now, profiling for any criminal or terrorist effort is very difficult, given that we're talking about a small percentage of a large population. That said, are we getting a profile of the people that these online recruitment efforts are targeting to try to recruit to work on behalf of ISIS or Al-Qaeda in a region?
Yeah, every country has its own policies and laws with regard to the limits on profiling. Here in the United States, most recently, the Obama administration has announced new rules that seriously restrict the practice of profiling on the basis of religion, ethnicity, race, and the like, and limited to possible consideration of profiling like behavior at borders. So only in those situations where you might be dealing, for example, with a foreign fighter who's returning.
Now, Al-Qaeda, one of their tactics was kind of this decentralized, almost franchise model where different organizations around the world would be loosely affiliated. Are we even more decentralized now where the person inspired online, maybe training, we can't even consider them a, if you'll excuse the phrase, a card-carrying member of the organization that inspired them?
I think that's true, and I think what's happening now is that some of the radicalization is occurring virtually, and the training in small arms fire and the like, of course, isn't as demanding as learning some of the more sophisticated or bigger terrorism devices that we have feared. So these things can occur virtually anywhere, and once they say these two brothers in Paris, once they have allies, as we see in that in further reporting about the situation in France, they may have a cell, in effect, simply of like-minded people who connect virtually, say, through social media.
Now, we've seen the word lone wolf or wolf pack used to describe people who have carried out attacks in over the last 3 to 5 years. Is that a worthwhile way to think about some of these terrorist attacks?
It could be lone wolf. We, you know, that euphemism is often used in the United States in connection with surveillance activities that used to be that we always had a predicate requirement before we engaged in electronic surveillance for intelligence purposes that there be a connection between the target of surveillance and some foreign group. That's not the case anymore. After 9/11, the so-called lone wolf possibility was identified. So now a sole would-be terrorist is amenable to surveillance. But, you know, so the problem, as I said some minutes ago now, is the volume of travelers or those who might be radicalized in these ways is such that it's very difficult to keep a tab on individuals and legally questionable if they're simply engaged in expressing their opinions and they haven't violated any laws.
Is there a worry about a downward spiral of radicalization where there's an attack like the one in Paris and there's backlash against Muslims in some parts of France, as there has been, which in turn radicalizes the next round of attackers?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of fear about that very cycle in Western Europe as we speak. I think not so much here in the United States. Fortunately, we haven't been victimized in quite that way. But I think Germany, France, Belgium, England, and so on, I think, yes, that's very much on the minds of officials there.
So how do those officials try to rein that in, make sure there isn't that backlash?
As I understand it, from the reporting from France, not only they're doing two things. They're certainly increasing the presence of police and military at key places, of course, religious places throughout the country, particularly protecting Jews, but also at public monuments and places of mass transportation and the like. At the same time, I think these CVE programs, the programs that would counter the tendency toward radicalization, are being stepped up as well. That, of course, is not something that you accomplish overnight.
The Netherlands has a radicalization hotline, I understand, that offers advice. So you're a parent, you're worried about your kid getting radicalized, maybe trying to join a group like ISIS. Is that something you think would be an effective approach for this CVE, counter violence education?
I think it might. I think one of the things we learned after 9/11 in this country is that you try everything. You have several things, several programs and approaches to countering terrorism or violent extremism going on simultaneously, and you observe to see which ones are more effective than others.
We're talking with counterterrorism expert William Banks about how terrorism has evolved over the last decade or so, and these attacks like we've seen in Paris, small groups, locally raised terrorists, how we as a society, as counterterrorism programs, might adapt.
And you can join in our conversation. Are you concerned about the prospect of small-scale terror attacks? How well prepared do you think the U.S. is to stop them from happening? And are you concerned about national security stepping on civil liberties? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the state of terrorism today with William Banks, director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University.
And you can join the conversation. How well are we keeping up with evolving threats to national security? What, if anything, can we learn from what happened in Paris last week? Are we at risk, do you think, of this kind of attack here in the United States? What would you like to see from counterterrorism? And do you worry about risks to civil rights in the fight against terror? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org. William, there's been talk over the last decade at least about how much international cooperation we have when it comes to tracking potential terror threats, people who might present a risk. How is the Western world doing on that? Where is there room for improvement?
You know, it's timely to ask about that because there's actually a new initiative that was enacted by the Security Council of the United Nations this September. Sponsored actually by the United States, called Resolution 2178, that commands states to take measures to halt the flow of foreign terrorist fighters. And it does much more than that because it does create programs that will encourage more international cooperation in that regard. I think now in intelligence and law enforcement, certainly the Western democracies have a pretty extensive network of cooperating in countering terrorism. It's gotten better, particularly since 9/11. And, you know, I think there have been some bumps along the way, particularly caused by the TSA, the NSA surveillance scandal of a couple of years ago and the Snowden releases. But I believe those differences are being patched up.
Now, some of the most heinous terrorist attacks are happening not in the Western world, but committed by groups like Boko Haram, by ISIS acting in Syria and Iraq. Does the Western world have a responsibility to take action, as it is to some extent against ISIS, for terrorism that presents threats over there, not so much necessarily over here right now?
Well, I think many of us believe that we all have a responsibility when egregious human rights violations occur to take steps to remediate or stand in the way of those violations. And certainly in Syria, it's very, very difficult because of the geostrategic and political considerations. But in places where there are sovereign states that are unable to control the terrorist activity inside their border, in those states in Africa that you're referring to with Boko Haram or al-Shabaab in Somalia and others, there's certainly, I think, a responsibility of the international community, and it's being addressed certainly by United Nations peacekeepers where those are able, and by the United States and coalition partners in some places. I think because the terrorist threat that we've been talking about before your news break is so diffuse now that it's impossible to tell where we might be attacked next. So it's certainly, as a matter of policy and a matter of law, probably proper for the United States to undertake countering terrorism in a place as far away as Somalia.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Harry on the line in Madison. Harry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We seem to be going round and round and round this foreign fighters issue. There's a very simple way to deal with it. If they're American citizens and they express some kind of desire to come back here and attack the government or the people, you charge them with treason and you lift their citizenship. If that's not possible constitutionally, you lift their visas so they can't come back. Very simple. That's my solution.
Harry, thanks for the call. Is it that easy, William? I mean, people don't necessarily publicly express this direct desire to attack the United States before they do it.
Well, if they do, it's almost as easy as Harry suggests. They can certainly be charged with violating a federal crime that we call providing material support to terrorism. It's not the same as treason, but it can be a serious criminal charge with lengthy prison term. But as your comment, Rob, implies, these guys aren't going to talk about what their plans are. So it places a far heavier burden on the intelligence mechanism to work accurately and try to predict these people, or in the communities to allow family members and others to sort of send a warning before something bad happens.
Harry, thanks for the call. We'll go to Kayla now in La Crosse. Kayla, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call. I guess looking at the issue of terrorism, we're very quick to blame the Muslim community. But as a Western nation, I should just think about how sometimes when we interfere with international disputes, how that makes other countries or certain groups of people want to attack us. And secondly, I just think sort of the political climate here in America, along with the racism, kind of contributes to young people wanting to get involved in this.
Kayla, thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, are there things, William, that we should change in American foreign policy that might currently be stirring up feeling against the United States?
Well, certainly there may be. I think, though, it's important. I think Kayla's made a very nice observation to talk about those who are engaging in these attacks as not representing Islam in any way. They may be Muslims, but this isn't about the Muslim world or about Islam as a religion. I just came from a workshop in Saudi Arabia last month where we're talking about Muslim-majority states standing tall to counter this message that these groups may, in effect, bastardize the Muslim religion, Islam, in support of terrorist activities, when in fact, of course, the activities that they're engaging in are antithetical to the fundamental principles of the religion. So we have to worry about stereotyping, we have to worry about profiling, but we also have to make sure that Islam is not the target of these of the messages that any of us disseminate.
And Kayla said also discrimination, racism here in the United States might be something that radicalizes people here in the United States.
I think it may well be, and it's a very good point, and that gets back to the really grassroots efforts to build trust, develop other narratives, get groups to engage on the issues that are causing the frustration of young people in particular. They're real issues, and they're important. But it's far better to deal with them at those grassroots levels than to try to stop someone before he or uses a weapon or attempts to inflict a terrorist harm.
Kayla, thanks for the call. We go now to David with us in Ironwood, Michigan. David, hi.
Yeah, I think the best anti-terrorism is good-paying jobs. How often do you see people? Yeah, there are a few, but you don't get big following until people are poor and desperate, and then they join these idiot groups. Just improving the economy and the pay of people and stuff would really, I think, do a lot to get rid of a lot of this terrorists.
David, David, thanks for the call. Is there something to that argument that economic turmoil, high poverty might inspire people to join these groups, William?
I think there is. I think his comment is spot on in many respects. We have to remember, though, that the classic attacks for 9/11, for example, those hijackers were primarily from middle class and fairly well-to-do families, many of them with college degrees, and so they were making their plans and preparations and their anger and hatred for the West based on a much different platform. But these days, I think particularly in Western Europe, those immigrant communities are at the bottom end of the economic spectrum, and I think improving that posture would make a difference.
Now, we're hearing from, as we heard earlier, the Attorney General on these issues coming up. I think in about a month there's going to be a conference represented from the U.S., Western Europe, and elsewhere getting together trying to figure out how to combat the threat of international terrorism, maybe the homegrown kind, too. What kind of things are you hoping to see from that international effort?
Well, I think that the need in many states to take better steps to criminalize the preparation for terrorism, the financing of terrorism, the returning from abroad to engage in terrorist activities. We have sophisticated laws and administrative mechanisms to respond to those problems here. And so does most of Western Europe. But there are many places where the problem is serious. In Turkey, for example, where the legal measures are not sufficient and where there's not an infrastructure to protect against it. So I think there'll be a lot of effort drawn to those places in the globe where there's a good deal of lax border controls, a fair amount of ease of exporting weaponry and other illicit activities, and get those states and those areas of the world in better shape.
William, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That's William Banks. He's director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University. 47 years ago today, Johnny Cash played his famous 1968 concert at Folsom State Prison.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone.
This historical performance further established the Man in Black as a musical trailblazer and spiritual voice of the underdog.
To talk about the significance of that concert, we're joined now by Michael Streisguth, author of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison, The Making of a Masterpiece. Michael, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, this was not your typical concert. What was the scene like inside this prison dining hall when they were getting ready for this Johnny Cash show?
Well, if you look at the photographs taken by the rock and roll photographer legend Jim Marshall, as the troops made their way into the prison, there seemed to be kind of a sense of dread hanging over things. Now, some of that might have had to do with nerves, just over how this recording would go. Cash had finally gotten the permission to record an album in prison. At the same time, some of the people I've talked to said that they were worried about June Carter, who was there with them, that somebody might lunge for her. Somebody told me also that when they entered the gate and were searched and were told that the prison didn't negotiate with hostage takers, that kind of sent a chill through them as well.
So what was going on in Johnny Cash's life at the time he played this concert?
You know, it wasn't a great time in his life and career. He was deep in a drug addiction. He hadn't had a big country pop hit in a number of years along the lines of, say, I Walk the Line or Ring of Fire. He was often no-show at his concerts, so he was quite unreliable on the performance circuit. So something needed to happen, and this album, which almost immediately jetted to the top of the country charts and the pop charts, really helped turn his career around.
Now, Johnny Cash, as I understand it, had played a concert at San Quentin Prison before he played at Folsom. What was it at that time that spoke to him about reaching out to prisons and getting involved in that issue and with those people?
You know, his prison shows stretched back to the 1950s. He had gotten a letter from an inmate at Huntsville State Prison in Texas. A lot of people heard his Folsom Prison Blues song, which was a hit in 55 and 56, and just assumed that he had been in prison when of course, he never had done hard time. He was in jail a few nights here and there for this and that. And so he was invited to perform, and he did. And he then, as you mentioned, began playing a string of New Year's Day concerts at San Quentin in California. He saw the kind of diversion that a prison concert could be for the inmates. And he also saw just how rowdy and into his show they were. So he knew that if he ever was able to bring recording equipment into a prison and release an album, that it would do well, that it would sound great. The trouble is he had difficulty convincing his record label, Columbia, to allow him to do it.
And there was that element of risk and danger you mentioned, worries about what might happen. Was there ever a problem, a bad situation at Folsom or his other prison shows?
You know, generally, no. There's a story from the 1970s when he went into a prison and there was some hostility among some of the audience who really weren't interested in seeing him. The times were changing by the 1970s, but generally, no. The inmates welcomed him. They really seemed to sense that Cash understood and sympathized with their plight. In fact, I interviewed Merle Haggard, who was at San Quentin as an inmate in the late 1950s when Cash performed. And he said, you know, Cash was somebody on the outside who appeared to be making it, and if he could be making it on the outside, maybe we could too. And he suspects that Cash knew that if it hadn't been for good lawyers, for example, Cash had been arrested for bringing amphetamines into the country from Mexico in the mid-1960s, that he too may have been in prison, that Cash understood that there wasn't much distance between him and a prison sentence. And the inmates picked up on that. And that gave the album an edge, you know, just the idea that that's recorded in prison. The idea that these men are rapists, they're murderers. It's something actually that the record company, once it did release the album, really exploited, and in order to help sell the album.
Yeah, there's a moment in the album that always sticks out to me. Is he sings a line something like, "He killed a man just to watch him die," and then this cheer goes up from the audience, from the inmates. Do you know anything about that moment and how real it was?
I do, as a matter of fact. When I wrote the book that you mentioned, Sony, which owns Columbia Records now, kindly let me into their archive to listen to the raw tape. And as I was listening to the raw tape, the actual recording, I hear him sing, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." And it's silent. There's no crowd noise. And I asked the engineer to rewind it, and he was even befuddled. We didn't hear this crowd noise. Well, then we got the edit that was used to actually press the album. And sure enough, we're watching that tape roll by, and he sings, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die," and you see a piece of tape, and then these shouts and hoots, and then another piece of tape. That had been edited in for dramatic effect, and I think everybody who's found this out has been surprised. It's really so much part of the DNA.
Yeah,
of
sounds
that album.
A little disingenuous and sort of misrepresenting of, you know, the atmosphere there too.
Well, I think it did give the album again that element of danger that Columbia wanted in order to sell the album. At the same time, that's not the only editing that occurred. Cash went into Folsom Prison on January 13th, 1968, and recorded two concerts. And the album is the result of those two albums. So bits and pieces were taken from both shows.
Now, you mentioned Johnny Cash dealing with addiction then and at other points in his life. What was his state, or do we know his state of mind actually going out on stage? Was he taking pills for that show?
You know, Marshall Grant, who I interviewed, he's since died, he was Cash's bass player, says that Cash was about 60% straight that day, which was about as close as you could get him to clarity. But I want to say this, that the album signaled not only a renaissance in his career, but also a few very good years in terms of his health. He did for a time put aside his drug habit. It would come back in the 1970s, but the affirmation that this album gave him seemed to replace the drugs there for a while.
As you listen back to it, and you've studied it, you've listened to it a lot, what moments stick out to you as the most transcendent or powerful?
Yeah, you know, Cash had heard about this inmate named Glenn Shirley, and Shirley was in Folsom. He played the guitar, he wrote songs, and Shirley gave some of his songs to a preacher who Cash knew. And the preacher gave those songs to Cash, and Cash decided that, hey, wouldn't it be a great idea to bring these songs into the concert? And he recorded on the album the song Greystone Chapel, and it's really it's the moment that I think defines the album, because here he is reaching out to an inmate. He's singing his song. He's bringing the connection there in very clear terms, and so the cheering that you hear when he introduces Glenn Shirley is not manufactured. It's not a studio trick. Clearly, the audience just loved the fact that Cash was reaching out to this individual inmate.
Michael, we're talking about this all these years later. You've written a book all about this recording and this album. What is it about this album that makes it loom large in our American musical landscape?
You know, every once in a while, somebody in country music, there was a chat about this on Facebook today, records something that's significant. And this album intersected its message that we should really have compassion for people who are on the fringes of society. It was a very 1960s message. And so it intersected with a mood in the country that art and music could be used to draw attention to social issues. And I think that message never gets old. On the other hand, you know, the Americans' interest in darkness and the legend of the outlaw, which also kind of emanates from this album, has never died either. So I think it remains evergreen for that reason. It's social message and its edge.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Michael Streisguth, the author of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison, The Making of a Masterpiece.